You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris, and you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. In 2016, we've spoken to a lot of people about some of the most pressing issues faced by the country today. Among them are the very people we've put in place to lead this country, those ministers and politicians directly involved in making policies and decisions that affect the direction of the nation. So today, in our last Breakfast Grill for 2016, we have, for your listening pleasure, highlights from those interviews. Let's begin with the Deputy Home Minister, Datuk Nur Jazla Mohamad, who was on the Breakfast Grill to discuss Malaysia's foreign labour policy. Earlier this year, the Human Resources Ministry signed an MOU with Bangladesh to bring in 1.5 million workers over the next 3 years. But then, the very next day, the Home Ministry announced a freeze on the intake of all foreign workers. Here's an excerpt of my interview with the Deputy Home Minister back in April. Before we go any further, Datuk, it has to be asked, do we want more foreign labour in this country? Do we need it?
From the government's perspective, no, because the number of foreign workers we have in this country is already becoming a burden on us. There are about 2.2 million registered foreign workers and probably a lot more.
So from where you're sitting in the government, you don't think the economy needs any more foreign labour?
Listen, there's a misconception that people think that the government is bringing in foreign workers. The government is only facilitating the demands for foreign workers from employers in this country. So it should be the responsibility of the employers to basically take care of the foreign workers and pay for the costs of having the foreign workers in the country.
You know, I've seen both sides of the argument. Those who say that we can't and shouldn't absorb more foreign labour. On the flip side, businesses who are struggling, saying they can't cope due to the severe labour shortage. This seems to be an incoherent policy in foreign workers.
I think there is a strong need for the government to basically be more strict on the intake of foreign workers. Because all this while, businesses have been using the excuse of, you know, not being able to operate without workers. But they don't seem to be encouraged to take local workers. If this issue goes on, it will have a big impact on the prospects of local workers in this country where, you know, the employers are not interested in basically taking them in and training them. On the other hand, we are taking in foreign workers who have no basic training or skills. We train them, and then in a few years' time, they'll go back to their country and help to develop their country. So therefore, there needs to be a balance between the requirement of foreign workers in this country and also the needs for the local workers.
Yeah, I have so many questions on just the things that you mentioned. I mean, how many do we let in? How long do we let them stay? Mm-hmm. How much do we charge? Mm-hmm. What about local workers? So let's just delve into all that. But first, to be frank, do you think that Malaysia has a coherent foreign worker policy? If you could sum it up for us, what is the basis that determines that?
I think we have come to the stage where we will be a developed country by 2020, which is not far away, which is only 4 years. The country cannot be a developed country with a high dependence on foreign workers. Technology ladder. They have to move up.
Because there are developed countries that have foreign workers. The US, for instance.
Yes, but to do menial jobs and dirty, dangerous and difficult jobs. Even then, even the US, it's becoming a political and social issue where these workers are registered as voters. These workers are living off the public housing system, public health system. They don't pay any contributions to pension funds. You know, and basically they take money out. Last year, it was estimated that 37 billion ringgit was remitted back to home countries by the foreign workers through official channels. Unofficial channels, maybe more. So you have a lot of impact across the society, across the country, to having foreign workers in this country.
It seems to me that you see foreign workers more as a national security issue and a home ministry issue rather than a human resource need and human resource ministry issue.
We look at it from an overall perspective. At the home ministry, our job is basically to ensure security for the country so that the country can prosper. For example, the issue of foreign workers being brought in, 1.5 million Bangladeshi workers we brought into this country. Mm-hmm. I must clarify this matter because there's been a lot of criticism to the government on this matter. The 1.5 million Bangladeshi's intake was negotiated by the Human Resources Ministry at the request of the Bangladeshi government. Malaysia has been offered these 1.5 million workers, but we are not taking 1.5 million. That is the total being offered to all the countries in the world, including Malaysia. But Malaysia is the first country to sign it. So we will only take foreign workers based on future needs.
Another key theme that emerged this year was the challenge posed to federalism, as groups from Sabah and Sarawak called for greater autonomy from the Federation. Back in September, on the eve of Malaysia Day, Ibrahim Sani spoke to Sarawak MP and ministers in the Prime Minister's Department, Datuk Nancy Shukri, about the devolution of power to the state.
Any devolution of power essentially needs amendments to at least some of the laws in the country, and more so, some of the constitution paragraphs have to be changed. Do you think, realistically speaking, this can be done?
I've seen that. If you really want this to happen, whether you like it or not, it is going to affect the federal constitution. For example, Article 1 in bracket 2, if I'm not mistaken, is talking about the states in Malaysia are these 13 states, and that's Sarawak and Sabah inside there. And if Sarawak and Sabah disagreed to that, therefore we have to change that. We have to amend that. And whether that can happen or that whether we want that to happen. So it's subject to the agreement of this committee later, because this is going to be brought to whatever you want to table. If it is the federal constitution, we need to, when we want to amend it, you need the two-thirds in parliament.
Okay, so this is when YB Chong Cheng Jian, the Dun of Kota Sentosa in the state assembly of Sarawak, as well as the MP for Bandar Kuching, he is saying that some of the opposition MPs from Sabah and Sarawak are willing to partner up with Sabah and Sarawak BN.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to say is that there is some semblance of a Sabah-Sarawak caucus that might not vote along coalition lines.
Yes.
Is this unrattling the Prime Minister because some of his, well, coalition members are thinking along the lines of Sabah-Sarawak rather than the coalition interest?
It's quite premature to comment on this because they will have consensus on what they're going to agree on. Definitely, they're not going to rattle the political and then the position of the Prime Minister.
YB, do you see Sarawak getting more autonomy at the end of the day?
I can see that. I can see that because the Prime Minister is willing to work with Sarawak, because in one way or another, he can picture, visualize what is it that Sarawak really wanted. But now it's a matter of putting things in writing. Of course, one of the issues is the royalty.
The oil royalty.
Yeah. So talking about royalty, they have to work out on the formula, whether it is reasonable to ask for royalty for 20% now, because the revenue is based on the revenue on our oil and gas. So, you know, we have to look into all aspects.
So one of the core questions that I have is that you can still negotiate as an agreement basis. You don't have to have full autonomy over it. Because, in fact, Terengganu is having some issues with oil royalty, with the federal government. Kelantan as well.
Mm-hmm.
Must Terengganu and Kelantan also fight for autonomy the way Sarawak is? Because
it's up to them. It's up to them. But I know Terengganu had been bringing the federal to court. So it's up to them, whatever. Because Sarawak is just acting for Sarawak. So if they feel that the federal thinks that they should not ask for autonomy, they should just ask for devolution of power, whatever it is. I mean, it's just a team. It's not really something that is really trying to get out of Malaysia. It's not like that. It's just, you see, what Sarawak is asking for is what they should have been given before. We are not asking for more than what have not been promised. But this is what had been promised under the Malaysia Agreement.
That was an excerpt of our breakfast grill with the Minister in the Prime Minister's Department, Datuk Nancy Shukri, on Sarawak's call for greater autonomy. After this, we take more policymakers to task to answer some of the most pressing issues facing the country, including efforts to unwind 1MDB and addressing the growing reach of Islamic bureaucracy in Malaysia. Stay tuned to The Breakfast Grill's 2016 in Review, BFM 89.9. Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill, and today we take a look back at 2016 and present you highlights of interviews we did with various ministers this year. Senator Datuk Dr. Ashraf Wajdi Dusuki is the Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department in charge of religious affairs. Agencies under his purview include the Islamic Development Department, or better known as JAKIM, and the Malaysian Islamic Economic Foundation, or YAPIM. In April, Ibrahim Sani sat down with Senator Ashraf to discuss the many aspects of governing Islam in Malaysia.
The conclusion right now is that people believe that Malaysia is becoming more Islamic, if I may use the word. What is the comment coming from the government on the notion that the Federal Constitution of Malaysia states in Article 3, Islam is the religion of the Federation?
First of all, I think you have to complete the sentence of the Article 3 because Islam is not just a religion of Federation, but other religions may be practiced in peace and harmony in any part of the Federation. And we have been practicing this since our day one of independence. Of course, we respect the position of Islam as the religion of Federation, but there's no way we undermine other religion. And in fact, we can be very proud that we have the tallest statue representing Lord Murugan of Hindus. We have the tallest, biggest, largest statue representing Buddhism in Kelantan, of all the states. Kelantan housing the largest, not largest in Malaysia, but largest in Asia. And we never had experience even once witnessing Muslims demonstrating against all this building up of statues and so on. So we have been very tolerant, and we have to maintain that peace and harmony of having a diversity in our country.
Let's look at some of the practical applications of Islam being the official religion of the Federation. A lot of companies have embraced Sharia compliancy. Yeah. The certification presently accorded by the government is issued by Jabatan Agama Kemajuan Islam, or JAKIM.
First of all, I think we need to be very clear on this. When it comes to Islam, our constitution has laid down a very clear foundation from the very beginning. Then we come to Islam, it is not the responsibility of the federal. It's actually entirely the roles and responsibility, to be more precise, is under the state's jurisdiction. That's why when it comes to enforcement of a religious law, whatever related to Islam, it is actually under the purview of the states. JAKIM has no power to enforce any law. JAKIM has no authority to enact any law because this is the sole prerogative of the state. But where is JAKIM's role in managing the religious affairs? They are just a coordinating bodies because their source of power coming from the Rulers Council, Majlis Raja Raja. And the Rulers Council is the one who actually have the full authority on Islamic matters. And in fact, a year before I was appointed as the Deputy Minister, I was a senator. I voiced out in the parliament that we need to regulate those who wants to use the label of Sharia compliant. Because so far, we only have two industries that are being regulated when it comes to Sharia compliant matters. One is Islamic finance, banking, takaful, capital market, which is under the Islamic Financial Services Act as well as the Central Bank Act. The second is on halal industry. There is a regulation on using JAKIM's halal logo, but the enforcement is under the state's jurisdiction. These are the only two industries that are regulating those who claim they are fulfilling or complying to Sharia principles. Whereas other industries, we can see there are a lot of institutions, companies are actually trying to mislead people or deceive people by enticing them on Sharia compliant matters. For example, we have a lot of issues like direct selling, Ponzi scheme, scheme cepat kaya, under the labels of Sharia compliant. Even I saw Sharia compliant along on the buildings and so on. There's no such laws and regulation that regulate this.
Doctor, there are 14 departments under your department, including YAPIM, the Yayasan Pembangunan Islam Malaysia, yeah. JAKIM, we spoke about that earlier, JKSM, Jabatan Kehakiman Syariah Malaysia, MAWIB, IKIM, TV Al-Hijrah and so on. Yeah. Is 14 departments not enough to regulate these kind of malpractice of the use of Islam?
No, you have to understand, this each organization has its own roles and responsibilities. They are not actually law enforcement agencies. when we talk about Islamic agencies at the federal level, it depends on what type of agencies they are actually doing business. For example, Tabung Haji, they are mandated to managing pilgrims and as well as Muslim investments. TV Al Hijrah, for example, actually to promote Islam in the media. We have JAKIM as a coordinating bodies, as a secretariat to manage Islamic affairs at the federal level. But when it comes to law, when it comes to enforcement of rules and regulation, that is under the jurisdiction of the states. That's why if we want to have such a law, we also need to manage and coordinate the states as well, which is not an easy task because we have to win over each state's confidence and their approval for such a demand or need for regulation.
In July, we also had Second Finance Minister Datuk Johari Abdul Ghani on The Breakfast Grill. Now, this interview took place just weeks before he took on the job following that cabinet reshuffle. So here's an excerpt of that interview in which Ibrahim Sani discusses the role of the Ministry of Finance in corporate Malaysia and the concentration of power in the office of the executive.
Let's talk about corporate governance, Datuk.
Yeah.
Why is it that the Malaysian Prime Minister is also the Malaysian Finance Minister as such?
Well, I think I'm not in the position to comment this, but what I want to tell you is if you look at during Tun Mahathir's time, he also occupied that Finance Minister position and Tun Abdullah Badawi. And obviously, I think when Datuk Najib came in, and they also do the same thing. And we look at the state, for example, in Sarawak state, the Chief Minister also occupied the portfolio. So my question is, this is not an issue of whether you are Prime Minister, occupy Prime Finance Minister post. It's a question of whether you have the right people to do it.
Do you think that we have the right people to do it? Because there are examples that I will now quote. The Public Accounts Committee, for instance, did mention, because of the 1MDB episode, they have pointed out various governance issues, including simple things like naming the Prime Minister instead of the Finance Minister in their report.
Okay. Let me explain to you a bit about 1MDB issue. Where this so-called, you know, I'm sure you know about the Section 117.
Yes.
Okay. The Section 117 originated from TIA. See, at that time when TIA was incorporated and they want to raise 5 billion bond, they need a guarantee from the government. So what happened, and the government said, if I give you a guarantee, we need kind of a security so that anything that you want to invest with this $5 billion, you need to come and refer to the government. So this is where the clause came in, Section 117, at TIA level. But at that particular time, it was a prime minister also, a finance minister. So that particular time when the clause was introduced. But nevertheless, what I want to stress here, that Section 117 is only apply for the appointment of the board members and the CEO. The rest all follow Companies Act.
Speaking of which, the Board of Advisors have not been dissolved as per required, and also the Board of Directors also have been changed. It's now down to just 3 individuals. Now, you were quoted in the press saying that the 1MDB business model is not sustainable. Do you still stand by?
Yeah, I stand by that. You know, 1MDB business model is not sustainable, a wrong business model, weak management, poor governance. This is all I have summarized it from what I've read from PAC report. Okay? And that's the reason why we decided that we have to stop 1MDB. We run off the business. We take back some of the available asset. So we joint venture with other investors. Hopefully that we can develop this land like Bandar Malaysia, TRX, and come to 2023 or 2024, we will be able to see the values of all that asset.
Datuk Joe, do you believe that 1MDB, for whatever it's worth, is it going through a good restructuring process right now?
So basically, you ask me frankly, I think this is the best that we can do by making sure that there's no more loan being disbursed from 1MDB. We want 1MDB to stop their business, run off their companies, and hopefully by the time we clear all this, there's no more new additional business. And as far as asset is concerned, the one that like Bandar Malaysia, TRX, we want to make sure that we can maximize the values of this project. For example, Bandar Malaysia, we just concluded the joint venture with IWH and CREC. And this is something that we're looking something like close to about 40, 50 billion kind of development. Mm.
It seems that the government is undertaking a lot of these measures because of the way they need to rectify it. However, the public has yet to hear an apology on the mismanagement of 1MDB. Is the government going to offer one?
Well, I think at this moment, there's a lot of things we are unable to resolve. We have to wait for the process. I think with any other business that we have seen in the past, like, for example, be it how we defend our Forex, that we lost 30 billion, for example. And then we lost almost about, close to 15 billion as far as Pawaja is concerned. This is something that a strategic investment that we think at the origination of the ideas, it doesn't turn what it's supposed to be.
This is a recurring theme throughout the generations even, not just about 1MDB. You rightly pointed out Pawaja Steel, Malaysia Airlines, Malaysia Aviation Group, as it's called now. In fact, many of these companies, which is jointly held by MOF Incorporated or MOF, not many of them are doing too well.
Yeah.
But why is that?
Okay, so I think you must understand that some of the industry that we went in are because of strategic in nature. Strategic in nature, because we need to make sure that we have a proper airline running. But along the way, I think when you get a management that are not efficient enough to execute what we want, that is where you face this kind of problem. One. Number two, if you look at Kazana, for example, Kazana, the government set up this outfit and we give them a guarantee of 20 billion. But today, Kazana is actually one of the successful investment that the government have made. And today the value is 150 billion. It's just only a guarantee of 20 billion. Today they are 150 billion. While you look at the negative side of it, some of the strategic investment, it doesn't turn good. But you must also look at what we have done, some of it. So what I'm saying, that doesn't mean that when you have done good something, then you can have a space to do something no good. So that's not right. But again, I think some of the strategic investment, as long as you are in business, you are talking about risk, you are talking about something that's uncertain ahead of you. This is where I think I always make sure that in order to do that, I think from now on, we have to make sure these three things always exist. You must have a proper sustainable business model. You must make sure that you have a tip-top management, and you must make sure the proper governance. These are the three things. If you can put it mandatory for any companies that under MOF, I think we will be able to reduce this kind of issues in the future.
That was part of Ibrahim Sani's interview with Second Finance Minister Datuk Johari Abdul Ghani back in July. Now, you can revisit the full interviews with all the ministers you heard today. Just look them up on our brand new BFM app that's available on Apple's App Store and Google Play. You've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Melissa Idris for BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.